Okay, we're in the middle of discussion of responses to the problem of evil. What we did last week was basically the Ramban. Logically, the Ramban's approach, based on the scheme that I drew 2 weeks ago, the Ramban is modifying. I'm going to say he's attacking. He's modifying the line in the scheme, if you recall from then, that said that if you're good, you must be opposed to the existence of evil. What the Ramban does, he adds one word to that. If you're good, you must be opposed to the existence of unjustified evil. But there's such a thing as justified evil. Justified evil is evil which is justice. That's why it's called justified evil. Evil which is in response to sin. That's based on what's known as the free will defense. So we have to start with people who have the ability to sin, which is also evil. But God does not oppose actively the existence of sin. He could have, but he doesn't. That's because of a different reason. God doesn't oppose sin because free will is a greater good. So actually, may I spend a few words about this first point. The first point, which is, should be obvious to us, but isn't when people first raise the problem, is that it's not always true that it's either yes or no. Some situations are evil, but also good. So the existence of human sin is the example of that. Sin is bad. Sin is evil. But you cannot eliminate that evil without eliminating a good at the same time. The only way to eliminate sin is to eliminate free will. Eliminating free will is eliminating a good or a greater good. So that would be example, the first line that says the free will defense itself is based on that God cannot do the impossible. It is impossible to eliminate sin without eliminating free will. Therefore God is not opposed. He's opposed to sin, but he doesn't eliminate sin. The next line says that God does also not eliminate, what's more, he actively fosters punishment, which is also evil, but it's justified evil. So the good is not opposed to justice. The good, therefore, is not opposed to punishing the wicked. That's how the man played with the original scheme. First, explain that God is not omnipotent in the sense that he does not have the ability to eliminate all evil without eliminating a good. And two, second kind of evil is punishment. And then you do what the Ramban then claims. The Ramban's further claim is basically modifying the final line, and evil exists. The Ramban says no evil exists that doesn't fall into one of the previous two categories. The only two evils which exist in the world are sin and punishment of sin. For that, he has to admittedly play with the mitziyut. He has to claim that things which I think look like unjustified evil, Ramban will say, no, you don't understand. They're really justified evil because the things which I can't even explain to you, they're secret, they're hidden, they require a great deal of thought, but it'll all fall into that category. Today we're going to explore a different approach, which starts with admitting that there is evil in the world which is not a justified response to sin. In other words, the free will defense is correct. It definitely explains a great deal of things. There's no reason for anyone in Judaism to begin without accepting the free will defense, because we like free will. So therefore, a great deal of evil in the world is either the existence of sin or the existence of the response to sin. But it's not true that explains everything, which is where all defenses of God's justice fall, is in real cases. In theory, you can explain anything, but then you deal with real cases. There are many cases which I can explain, which I don't believe fall into any of the Ramban's categories. Birth defects, that's the easiest one. Children who are innocent, but nonetheless are suffering. So, of course, the Ramban will say Gilgul, but if we just ignore that kind of response, or other cases, too great an evil, person who suffers too much, he's not a bad tzaddik. He might have some hidden sins, but he's like been wallowing in pain for the last 50 years. It can't be explained. That's the claim. You can't explain it, but we need another kind of explanation. In other words, there is such a thing as unjustified, meaning not based on justice. There is evil which is not based on justice, but it exists and God doesn't oppose it. So I'm going to explain how this works, and we're going to try to explore some of the implications of it, because it's not merely a response. It's not merely a what's known as apologetics. It's not merely a defense of what is, but once you understand it, it becomes a very positive force for understanding the outlook on life and how God operates in the world. It all begins with a line found in no, I'll stop before that. Let me go back one step. In the Middle Ages, they played with the following kind of ideas, which is the beginning of the idea that we're looking for. What we're looking for is to explain why evil is evil, but its presence in the world contributes to a greater good. Well, it's not like the Ramban's line. Ramban is saying that evil is evil, but when you do evil to evil people, that's good. Now they say, no. The evil itself is evil. But in a greater picture, if you look at the world, which consists of ingredients A, B, C, and D, one of them is evil, the whole chowant is better than if evil wouldn't be there. That's the kind of move we're going to do. So I'll just give you, because a little bit of background, because it's cute the way they used to do these things in the Middle Ages. They thought in a certain manner, in a way, they thought they have to give examples of that to make you convinced that it could be true. So they did a line like the following. I don't remember where this is from. I don't think it's from a Jewish source. But it says like, what you ask the question, like, what is the best color? What is the most beautiful color? So a person will answer. Certain colors are not beautiful. Certain colors are beautiful. So sky blue is my favorite color. I think that's the most beautiful color. Now the question is, what do you think of a painting that consists of only sky blue, as opposed to a painting that consists of the Battle of Calvo in 1492 with horses and blood and death and all kinds of things in it? So many of the elements in the second painting are not pretty, they're ugly. There's a big slab of black. Black is an ugly color. But the painting as a whole is more beautiful than the painting that would be pure blue. That's just an example. It doesn't prove anything for what we're talking about. But it says how it just shows you how you can't think simplistically. That's the point of the example. That sometimes the contrast between, in this case, aesthetics, not ethics, the contrast between beautiful and ugly creates a greater beauty than just beauty itself. So in ethics, it's going to run by that the combination of good and evil is more good than just good alone. Now, how is that done? So it begins with, it doesn't begin historically, but it begins for us with a line that's found in Chasei Kreskas, the discussion of the Akedah. And the Akedah begins with Hashem Nisa et Avraham. God tested Avraham. That's a little translation of the word. All the Rishonim ask, what does it mean to test? Normally, human beings test others in order to know the answer, in order to know what they are, whether they can pass the course. But God knows the answer. Why does God have to test Avraham Avinu? He knows that Avraham Avinu is either good or not good, is either good enough to sacrifice his son or not good. In fact, he knows that Avraham Avinu is good enough to sacrifice his son. So why does he need to test Avraham Avinu? I mentioned the answer of the Ramban last week as simply an example of the way the Ramban treats tzaddikim and not tzaddikim. The Ramban says that God tests Avraham Avinu so that, of course, Avraham Avinu will pass, but there is a greater reward given to he who has done good deeds than he who has the commitment, the heart, leif tov. He has the personality which would do good deeds. There's a greater sachan. Then I explained last week, because Ramban is working on two different bases, who you are and what you deserve. You deserve is payment. Who you are is that you're a tzaddik anyhow. Rav Chasei Kreskas says the following. There is a klal in human nature that's called Achrei Halev Holech Hamasim. Halev Yakneh. Hamasim Yiknu. Tchunot Lanefesh. V'kol Shekein Sheyechasku Et HaTchunot Shekayamot Mishekfar. He says the following, that developing human personality depends on actions. And this is probably more familiar to many of you from the Sefer HaChinuch. If you've ever read through the Ta'amim in Sefer HaChinuch, there are numerous places, at least five or six, I think it might be more, where the Chinuch points out that this thing is a mitzvah not because God wants the result. In other words, in mitzvah tzedakah, for instance, the Chinuch says, God doesn't tell us to give tzedakah because poor people need tzedakah. If God thought that poor people need money, he would give them the money. Why should he tell you to give them the money? God tells us to give money to tzaddikim not to make poor people richer, but to make the givers more merciful. Because how does a person become a rachum? Only by engaging in acts of rachmanut. So you give tzedakah, not that you should think this, that's another question, we'll talk about this some other time, but not that you should think this, but he's telling you the truth. Why did God command people to help poor people? To make the givers more generous, rather than to make the poor people rich. And that's based on a psychological yisod, which in order to justify evil will have to be a logical psychological yisod. You couldn't do it any other way. Sheha'ma'asim yiknu yaknu tchunot lanefesh, v'kol shekein sheyechasku et ha'tchunot im kayamot mishekfar. The only way for a person to achieve, to acquire a certain character, is by doing actions which, I'm going to use the normal word, which reflect that character. But what the Chinuch and the Chaskai Kresk have just done is that actions don't reflect your personality. Your personality reflects your actions. Or more accurately, that there's a elliptical kind of structure here. Obviously, we do that which we are capable of doing. Because I'm generous, I give tzedakah. But if I give tzedakah, I'll be more generous. And then, hopefully, I'll give more tzedakah. So just as our actions reflect our personality, our characteristics, our midot, so too, our midot are influenced, are built by our characters. That's Rav Chastai's explanation of the Akedah. That's how he explains the very, very difficult phrase in the Akedah, that God says to Avraham Avinu afterwards, Ata, with an ayin, Ata yadati, ki yirei Elokim ata. It actually says in the Pasuk that God tested Avraham Avinu in order to know what his character was. But we know that can't be true, but that's not, that, it's not only the word Naso, it actually says in the end, after when he passed, God says, now I know that you're yirei Elokim. So all Rishonim asked, how could that be true? God knew it before, and it actually says, Ata, now I know. Meaning, I didn't know that before, but that goes against basic Jewish theology. So the answer that the Chastai gives is that it means is that God didn't know that Avraham Avinu was Yirei Elokim beforehand because he wasn't Yirei Elokim. It means now I know that you're Yirei Elokim on this level, which you weren't beforehand, because only after you slaughtered, almost slaughtered Yitzchak, did you become, in fact, someone of a actual human personality, character, who is on the level called he who slaughters his child for God's will. So therefore God says, Atayadati, it really means Ata. Now it's true, and therefore now I know it. But before, it couldn't be known because it wasn't true. The application of this to the problem of evil is based on a different outlook as about to what God is doing in the world. The free will defense is viewing God as being a judge. God made the world and made people creation was not judgment. Creation was chesed. Olam chesed yibaneh. God created the world, he made the world very, very good because he wanted to do good for the world. One of the things he gave to the world was human free will. Then, after that, we can safely stop talking about God's goodness. It's true, but it's not necessarily relevant to what we're talking about. Now God acts as a judge. When you use your free will for good, he gives you two little candies. When you use your free will for bad, he gives you two little shmeis and panim, two little smacks in the face. That's the way what the Torah says takes place. What Pashat v'chukotai says takes place. And what Raman says is the only thing which takes place. That's the free will defense. What we're saying now is that God's chesed doesn't end. That the basic, the most important, not that the first doesn't exist, it also exists, but what we're going to concentrate on, the most important nature of God's relationship to the world isn't being a judge responding to what people do, but God is a mechanech. The good that God is trying to achieve in the world is personality development. God, hashkacha, is a field whereby God challenges us or sends us experiences or calls for us to engage in experiences which will develop our personalities in a particular direction. Which direction? The direction of being better, the direction of being like God, and of being good. There's a very basic distinction here. I took this when we talked about Hashkacha first time, between God as reacting to human deeds and here God as setting up the situations which create human deeds or call for human deeds to take place. The ultimate interest of God is human character. It's what's called, there's actually a Christian term, but it's the right term here, soul building. God is interested in developing human beings. But how does a human being develop? So now you have the club of Chasei Kreskos. The only way a person can develop is Achrei HaMaasim Holech Halech. Now, many human characteristics to exist, they could exist in theory without any evil in the world. But to do them, they involve reacting with evil. For instance, the case I brought from the Chinuch, generosity. Generosity can, I can have a generous character. For that, I don't need any poor people. But I can't do generous actions unless somebody is in need of help. The meaning of the character generosity is giving of your own to he who has less. There have to be people who have less. Courage. Courage is a midah which befoweth in actions. Again, if it was just a midah, you're courageous. But if it's, you can only become courageous by doing courageous actions. Courage is standing up to danger. Danger has to exist for a person to have courage. Etc., etc., etc. Why take this even more close to normal human suffering? So there's a midah in English called fortitude. It's a good midah. It's a good in and of itself. But fortitude is suffering in silence. It's the ability to carry a difficult situation without breaking, without complaining, without destroying yourself. So again, if it was merely a personality trait, it could in theory exist. I've made a computer and the computer has fortitude. Okay, but if the only way to achieve fortitude is to experience it, then you have to have a certain amount of suffering and you force yourself to do it, and then you become a stronger, greater individual, which is God's goal, which is God's goal in the world. I want to explain what we've just done now, because we've done something that's really radical. What the Ramban did, no one found extraordinary. It was obvious to all Jews, at least, and to almost all Jews, except for the Ramban. Almost all Jews, obvious that punishing the evil is a good thing. What we've just said now is that evil is good in and of itself. It's good that there were bad things, not because it's justified. Nobody did anything wrong. Avraham Avinu is a tzaddik. Avraham Avinu suffers on the way to the Akedah. He suffers. He spends 3 days torn between his love of God and his love of his child. It was not a happy experience. We wouldn't wish it on our enemies. It's not good. It's not a pleasant thing. God was not rewarding Avraham Avinu by sending him on those 3 days. But what we said was, yeah, it's bad, but it's good to have bad experiences, because in the end, Avraham Avinu will come out of that experience a better person. And the famous phrase that's very often used sarcastically or cynically, you know, if it doesn't kill you, then it strengthens you. That's the Yisod. Sounds like it comes from, Hollywood Western. Las de Crescas, 1492. Okay, it's an old Yisod. It's radical in the sense that we've actually justified evil itself. If the world was a more pleasant place, if we were living in Gan Eden, so Gan Eden is better than Alon Shvut 2011.
12.
Thank you.
Sorry.
I'm not sure whether you think you should get a Shekaya for that.
Sorry.
I think you're right. So let me just check. Yeah, you're right. It's also better. It's also better than Alon Shvut 2011. What's wrong with 2011?
Okay.
You think 2011 was better than Gan Eden? The way we would measure before of Chasai Kreskas, how much good is in Gan Eden, how much good is in Alon Shvut, there was more good in Gan Eden, a lot more. It was nice, things grew, nobody died, the animals were happy, nobody ate anybody. You picked a few trees in the morning, and at night you had a kumzitz, and then you went to sleep and you learned Torah. But for that reason, it was worse. Being better is being worse. That's the incredible statement there. I cannot stress how paradoxical, even though the idea sounds very, very simple, it's an extremely paradoxical reason. If it would be better, meaning nicer, which is better, if it would be more pleasant and less suffering, it would be worse. Because suffering is good. Now, it's not good to suffer. I want to point out something here. To modern Western ears, it doesn't sound that radical, because they've been awash in Christianity. In Christianity, suffering is good because suffering is good. We're not saying suffering is good because suffering is good. Suffering is terrible. Christians, for various reasons, namely because they worship suffering, have managed to turn say suffering is just good. It's just good. Suffering helps. Suffering is good. That's not what we're saying here. We're saying suffering is terrible. And that's why I want to apply the test I applied last week. The test is, what do you say when you see somebody suffering? I applied it last week to very simplistic theories. Those theories that say suffering doesn't exist. Or it doesn't count. Or it's only physical suffering. As a result of that, you come to the conclusion that we have no chiyuv to stop other people from suffering. But I'm saying now that's not true. Suffering is terrible. One of the goods that comes out of suffering is that it's a challenge to eliminate it. In other words, generosity. Why are poor people good things? Because other people could be generous. Not that, oh, poverty is a good thing, therefore we won't stop it. We're managing to really have our cake and eat it now, which is what's so extraordinary about this theory, even though it's not a particularly twisted or wild theory. The suffering is good, among other things, because we have to eliminate it. So it's not that we're redefining bad as being good. Bad is bad. And it's good that it's bad. Because it's bad, therefore you can have part of the true good is reacting towards evil, fighting it, eliminating it, standing up to it, all sorts of different midot which are directly involved in suffering. Right now I'm limiting it to those midot which you immediately realize: courage, fortitude, generosity. These are midot which are inconceivable on a practical level. Again, if you need ma'asim without the existence of evil, it doesn't in any way say that the evil is good. It took a lot of, I'll say something, God, you forgive me. It took a lot of guts on God's part to create evil only because he thought that it would cause people to become better. And I say that literally because I don't have the right to do that. It takes a lot of guts. It takes a lot of God power. I now have a theory that it seems to me, based on my limited knowledge and wisdom, which of course is a lot of knowledge and wisdom, that it would really, I'm almost certain that if I would go over to somebody in the room and all of a sudden twist his ear, it would be a really good thing because, you know, he'll develop a personality of, you know, tell me what developed just now.
I became like accustomed to earbending.
Well, it doesn't always work. But why won't I do it? Because it takes a lot of guts. In other words, you need a certain achrayut over somebody else. So I'll give you another example, which I've thought about very often, please don't check who my neighbors are. But let's assume that my neighbor is, the last few years, he had certain difficult times in his life, you know, he had children, he had to bring them up, it drove him crazy. He's an alcoholic. And because of that, he's lost his job, and they're living in poverty. So I did the following cheshbon, you know, if I give him any money, if I loan him some money, he needs to buy a new car, there's a good chance that he'll some of it he'll spend on drink, and the other he'll squander, and nothing really good will come of it. On the other hand, if I set fire to his house, there's a good chance, let's say, I'm almost certain, that, you know, that'll really make him realize that he's hit rock bottom, and he'll take care of his life, and he'll go out and get a job, and then go to AAA, AA, whatever it's called. The difference between AAA and AA. AAA is the cars, right? Yeah. He'll go to AA, then he'll go to AAA and get a car, and he'll straighten out his life. So, will I do it? Now, there are two reasons not to do it. One is because I'm not sure. But no, I'm a bad guy, but I'm sure it's going to work. In any event, it won't hurt. You know, giving him money for sure, that I'm sure is not going to work. So I don't do it, why not? He's not my child. He's not my Talmud. And I'm not God. He's my neighbor. I have to deal with simple ethics. Simple ethics says you help people who are suffering. But for my children, I do things like that. Because there I am like God. I have my kid. My kid asked me for a piece of candy. So, you know, he's a kid. I know it's going to ruin his teeth. What's more, he's not going to study. So I say to him, no, you learn 100 block by heart, and then I'll give you some food. You have 24 hours. 24 hours of hunger isn't the end of the world. It's a good tarkil. Not if your parents did this to you. Wow, you have very mean parents. This is what a good father does. No, you set challenges for your children. That's what I mean when I said it takes a lot of guts for God to do this, because it means doing evil, allowing evil, but really, we actually skipped a step. Not that God allows evil. I just said now is that God does evil. God, because he's interested in you, he doesn't merely allow the earthquake to strike and doesn't stop it. No, he sets the earthquake. Like the Rambam said that occasionally mountains fall down. God has waited, a year has gone by and no mountain has fallen down, and God says, my gosh, they're becoming, it's like the Marines, these guys are becoming soft. Where's their fortitude? Where's their courage? We have to, it's exactly like the Marines, we have to, you know, do something. We will have a live fire exercise, make them crawl on their knees. I've only seen this in movies, thank God. You know, we're shooting bullets over there. We're going to have an earthquake. And God makes a nice earthquake. And then in the end he says, well, look at all these people who became tough. You're going to ask a very simple question now. What about those people who didn't become tough? What about those people who had the earthquake and therefore they lost their minds, or they went and they stole from the other people and they raided the, when the generous people in America sent the Hercules with all the blankets, so they hijacked it and sold it on the black market. So it didn't do any good for them. That's true. free will. I'm not saying the Ramban actually says that God only tests those who he knows are going to pass. God's a Gemara to that effect. But for what I'm saying now, I don't need to say that. God's actually, he's taking a chance. Education is education. There's free will. Without the earthquake, no one's going to develop. With the earthquake, some will, some won't. Some might even become worse. That's their problem. Those who became better, God takes credit for doing it. Yes?
So does that mean if someday were able to eliminate many evils from the world, if they were able to eliminate poverty or hunger, does that mean we worsen the world in some way?
Good question. Not a really good question, but it's a good theoretical question. The answer is don't worry about it. But it is a good question. In the sense that is, that the pasuk says, "Ki lo yachdal ani mikev haaretz." When I was 14 years old, I made the mistake of going to Bnei Akiva. And in those days, this is 1964, Bnei Akiva was still a socialist organization. There were girls in Bnei Akiva, but it was a socialist organization. And so the first sicha I heard was about eliminating poverty. In those days, when you graduated Bnei Akiva, you actually went to kibbutz instead of coming to yeshiva. So I heard the sicha, I was a bit of a wise guy, and I said, but it's a pasuk in the Torah, lo yachdal ev yom yikev ha'achetz, we're not supposed to eliminate evil. The Torah says there will always be poor people. The answer is, you're supposed to eliminate evil, and don't worry about how God's going to manage to find out things for you to do. I'm sure it's not a rational thought, but we do have these crazy thoughts that say, what you're really thinking about is medicine, that's what you're really thinking about. So the fact is, are there less diseases? We have an obligation to eliminate disease. But sometimes you have this really wild thought that every time we eliminate disease, there's another one that pops up. We are not eliminating evil from the world. We're eliminating an evil. And you're making it more difficult for God to challenge you. He's a clever guy. He'll think of ones. So you'll say, but therefore you say, well, let's draw the upper cross. Therefore it's pointless. You know, because God is so committed to evil. The answer is maybe not. Maybe if you, the fact that we make a big effort to eliminate evil, maybe God will take that into account and say, you know, so they progress, and now we can work on something else, which may require less, the computation. Any defense of evil does not require, and cannot require, and should not require, that I will now explain to you before, I mentioned this 3 weeks ago, I will tell you now exactly why it's working the way it's working. We're raising the option. When something bad happens, I will say, kanir'eh, God is looking for this reason. As do I, in my limited sense, agree with God's equations here? Frankly, in my limited sense, no. I think God could have gotten ahead with a lot less. You know, he's doing a bit too much here. He could have gotten his results less. But obviously God disagrees. That's my point. I'm saying that God apparently disagrees. But I don't do the cheshbon on a world basis. It's beyond human computational abilities. On a small basis, the basis of my life, it's beyond human computational abilities. God is balancing here different traits, different goods, because on the other hand, he also is committed to being nice to tzaddikim. Well, somebody asked me last week, you know, the Ramban set up a situation whereby he was so successful, the man himself says, you'll be surprised when you see a tzaddik v'tovla. The line in the Ramban that says that God punishes tzaddikim in this world so they can give them more sachar olam haba. So therefore, if you have any sin at all, one or two sins, you're going to suffer terribly in this world so they can have more olam haba. So then you should be amazed, wow, tzaddik v'tovla, how can that be? So that was an interesting question. I think the man is aware of it. It's not a great question, but it's a good question. But it doesn't apply to what I'm saying now, because God is the one that committed. There's a good called tzaddik v'tovlo. There's a good called reward and punishment. There's another good called tzaddik v'od yoter tovlo. Tzaddik at a better test. If I'm a teacher in school, so if you do very well, I give you an assignment, and you do very well. So if I'm a good teacher, what do? I take you aside, I say the rest of the class will play with this, but you're going to get a much harder assignment because you have more potential. So then, when you were in fourth grade, you drew the correct conclusion. Don't do well on assignments because you get punished for it. You remember? That's a conclusion that any bright kid does. Bright kids in school get punished. How are they punished? The teachers give them more work to do. It's insane. If you're clever in school, you pretend to be an idiot, and then they let you out of everything. You don't have to do anything. You go home and you can just read books. Okay, no, that's basically your question. You know, so it doesn't pay for us to pass the test too quickly, because God, there's a. I think did I mention this medrash when we talked about the Akedah? There's a medrash which I understand. It's not 100% explicit, but I just said that's what Rav Avinu was saying to God. The medrash says that after the Akedah, God, remember, Eser Nisyonot Nitasav Avinu. According to the Chassid's explanation of Nisayon. Nisayon is a challenge for you to rise to a higher status. And therefore, Eser Nisyonot Nisav HaMavinu means, wasn't number 10 in here. There's no list of the 10. Rishonim try to count. It's very hard to get to 10. What does it really mean? 10 means all the time. Nisayon, Nisayon. It's a round number. It's a perfect number. 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 is 10. 1
plus 2
plus 3 yes. Plus 4 is 10. And Pythagoras thought it was a perfect number. It means Avraham Avinu's life consists of going from Nisayon to Nisayon. So after the Akedah, there's a Medrash that goes like this. I'm sort of distorting it to make it sound better. I don't remember the original version. I remember the way I understand it. Avraham says to God, that was Nisayon, right? And God says, right. And Avraham says, and I passed, right? And God says, 100%, really well. And then Avraham draws the conclusion. So that means that tomorrow, or probably I get off a day or two to rest, but next week there's going to be a bigger Nisayon, because it has to be bigger. And God says, you figured it out. Avraham says, I'd like to retire. This one was too difficult. I just can't go anymore. And then, Pilei Plaim, God grants him his wish, which is why Avraham lives another 45 years, and nothing happens. The Medrash says, Hashem Be'arach at Avraham Bakol, meant that Avraham Avinu was, there's a lot of explanations what Bakol means. This one says, Bakol meant that he was basically in Olam Haba, a life without Nisayon, but he was in Olam Haza. What's good about being in Olam Haza without Nisayon? You're not old enough to know. Rabbi Ryan, what's good about being Olam Hazeh if you have no Nisyona? You get to play with the Enikuch, you get to play with your grandchildren. Avraham Avinu spent 45 years playing with his grandchildren. When did he die? Different Medrash. What day did he die? When it was no fun playing with the grandchildren anymore. The day that Esav killed his first victim, came back from the Sadeva. Avraham Sadeva, who ayef? Why was he tired? Why was he weary? Better word. Why was he tired out? He had just come from killing his first victim, and there's no more Nachas v'neinikach. From Avinu, he may as well go to Olam Haba and forget about this world. That's the kibbutz of Medrash. So it's possible to say that it's good to go from Nisayon to Nisayon, but it's also bad. I also suffer from it. And Avraham Avinu made the cheshbon he made. I'm disappointed in Avraham Avinu. He should have gone on more. But it just shows you that there's a limit. But the same thing is true as to whether would you like to be Avraham Avinu. The reason why God has never asked me, Baruch Hashem, to sacrifice my child is because the same thing that he wanted to get from Avraham Avinu by having him sacrifice his child, he gets from me by asking me to get up in the morning. Which I occasionally do. Watch it. And I go to shul. That's you. Then God says to me, wow, ataya dati ki reelu kima. Because the only reason why I did it was because he asked me. Which is what Avinu, but Avraham Avinu was a problem. Avraham Avinu was such a good character that God was scratching his head, what can I ask Avraham Avinu to do, which he'll do only because I asked him. I should ask him to get stuck. No, he likes giving stuck. I'll ask him to show me Shabbos. He thinks Shabbos is a lot of fun. I'll ask him to run 600 miles from Sodom to Damascus in order to rescue his nephew. Piece of cake. It's wonderful. Avraham Avinu likes doing good things. I gotta ask him something to do that he won't possibly understand. What could that be? Oh, I thought to kill a son. That he's going to say, that's a good thing. That's a terrible thing. I'll do it anyhow. Baruch Hashem, I have a lot of things which I don't understand what I'm doing for. So therefore, I'm saved. So it's better to be a Beinoni or Mata. It's better to be a schnook like me than to be a Tzadik Avraham Avinu. Because Tzadik Avraham Avinu, you wind up having to sacrifice your children. Correct argument, but incorrect argument. But it's still a correct argument. Yes, it isn't necessarily pleasant to be a great tzaddik because your challenges are going to be more torturous than the challenges of somebody who merely has to develop a little bit of giving, a little bit of tzedakah to some poor person, lo no rab. But a great, generous person is going to have to give everything he owns to whatever. He's going to have to do much more in order to get to the next level of generosity. So in terms of divine wisdom, which is infinite, God is balancing that theory with the opposite theory. By the way, the opposite theory is true. We don't only grow from being challenged. Sometimes we grow from being just called. You know, God will say, maybe you'd like to do something good, and I'll do it. It doesn't always have to be that you get pushed, and therefore you push back. Both theories are true. And if every teacher knows that, every parent knows that. Sometimes you give a piece of candy to get the kid to do something. Sometimes you give him a whack in the behind to get him to do something. God has to balance out those two theories, plus the need to do justice, plus the need to stomp be good. God likes giving rain because he likes being nice. It's good to be good. And therefore, why assume? My bitachon now says whatever's taking place is taking place in the divine infinite calculus. I'm simply explaining one aspect of that calculus, or the one which we couldn't figure out. How is it possible that God does bad just because it's bad? The answer is it's always good to do something bad because someone will gain from it. I'll give you another example of how, I'll get in a second, how this can work. And this is really, it works, even though this can be a little bit, it can be a little bit painful. Okay. There's a book I once read, I actually got the Machon Library to order it, because I wanted to read it. I have that kind of protection. Book I want to read, I get them to order. And no one's read it since. I do believe it's not on the shelf, because after it came, it turned out that the cover was not very nice for Yeshiva. It was a picture of a guy in the cover. It's just that he was nailed to the cross and had a crown of thorns on his head. It's a book written by a nun about the power of evil. And she disagrees with all the theories that she knew about. And the book, I believe the book is called something like, in some place in the title of the book, in the subtitle of the book, it has, what's the word they use there? What it meant was unjustifiable evil. In other words, it brings a case where this person, he attacked this girl and cut off her arms and cut out her tongue, and like, what good could come out of that? In other words, she's not going to recover, and so it was unjustifiable evil. The thing is, the theory, you can never mevosh say that. The greater the evil, the greater the potential of a worthwhile response. Now that's something that's very difficult. I said 3 weeks ago that I'm not going to, don't attempt to get me, to give me a case, and I'll say, oh, I feel good about that case. If you live the case, I don't think it's even ethical to say, I think this is good. It's a theory. The theory, I believe, works from God's perspective. I hope it works from God's perspective. But if you bring me, if you wheel somebody into this room who's suffering immensely, and you want me to say, Aruch Dayan Emes, with a smile, I don't think I'm going to do that. I don't plan to do that. Hopefully I'll say Aruch Dayan Emes, but I don't have to smile when I say it. It requires, from our perspective, again, we're not God, from our perspective, to say, this suffering is justifiable because, you know, maybe not him, but somebody else, people who are watching it, they develop certain character traits. There's something a little bit callous about that. Before, in a given case. In theory, I think it works. But when existentially, when you're living the case, you have to be very careful about using this. This is something which I've carried since 19... Were you in Shear then? I think it was the year before that. 1966, there was a fire. The fire in Baltimore. You saw Raja Jay? So 66. What? Baltimore. Philly? There was a fire in the dormitory in Yeshiva. And three boys were killed. One of them, his father was a Yeshiva in YU. And so look at him, gone to the Shiva. And he came back and he told us how shocked he was that there was somebody came to the Shiva to be Menachem Avil. And he said true things, you know, he said the religious platitudes about the kids in Gan Eden and whatever. He said certain things. I don't remember what the exact lines were. The lines are found in Jewish philosophy. But I thought that, how can you say that to the father at the Shiva? I mean, it was like, he thought it was so callous to say. And I remember he talked about how, he was actually trying to say how you have to have an education in order to understand why you shouldn't quote everything that happens to be true. But part of getting a good secular education is understanding the sensitivity to certain kind of things, which you don't learn just by reading, halachas and Torah. So I remember that made a big impression on me, and I've carried it ever since. You can't always say things which are philosophically true, because they're evil to say, even though they're true in a more general sense. Yes, it is true that if you, it's not your problem. If we eliminate cancer, that creates a certain problem for God. Don't worry, He'll manage. He invented AIDS. He has ways to get around. That doesn't make your work, futile. You work to eliminate. You work with Bilal Mavet Netzach. The Gemara says in one place that Tov Mavet. In another place we say, we're in favor of eliminating death. When it happens, we know it's a good thing. It would be a better thing if it wouldn't happen. Our problem is to eliminate, we have to eliminate. God's problem is to eliminate what he has to eliminate. We've made a division of labor here. Yeah.
There are a lot of people that will get birth out of the earthquake, and there's some people that won't because of free will, but there are also people that died during the earthquake. Why? How did that happen
for them? So it's very, very complicated. There are, no, I was about to get to this. There are, in this theory, assuming that you understand that you think it works, there are certain philosophical and moral problems. I want to talk about the philosophical problem, I mentioned a moral problem. The theory works, among other things, by saying that, the case I gave, poor people are poor, right, that's not what the Chinuch says. The Chinuch says you have to give tzedakah to poor people to make yourself better. Using that as a basis for a theory of theodicy, theory of defending God, I'm saying, poor people are poor so that I should be generous. Now you ask, it's a less dramatic case, but it's exactly what you're asking. Is that, does that justify their poverty? Why do they have to suffer so that I can have the kef, I can have the pleasure of feeling generous? So that's a cynical way of putting it. Why do they have to suffer so that I can have the good? I can do acts of generosity. It's obviously, again, not something which we would be justified in doing. I would not, because I think you should be a generous person, I won't hit him so that you can live with menachem otom. Right? It makes sense. If I was a ganenet, I also wouldn't have the chutzpah to do that. I want my kids to learn how to help each other. So I break half their arm so the other kids can take them to the hospital. Something's a little bit weird about that. It's definitely a moral question. But first of all, yes, it's true. Second of all, again, you have to say that God is balancing. If you believe that God ain't avel, so when God has to choose between two people, which one gets to take him to the hospital, which one gets to break his leg, let's assume the guy broke his leg. There was another reason for that as well. He also had a few chatayim which need kapara, or he had a chatayim which need an onesh. The Gemara which says that apo pisha bat ludalit mitot, din dalit mitot lo batel. We don't have a Sanhedrin, therefore we don't kill people anymore. But if somebody's climbing a ladder and falls down and breaks his neck, you can assume, good chance, that he was chayiv skila. So again, you have all these multi different considerations going on, and God is running this entire world with a lot of hashgacha pratit. He's pulling a lot of strings here, and each person is in the role which is justified for him. Now, if you're talking about death, which is the case that you brought, if it wasn't death, it was just breaking a leg, so you also gain from breaking a leg. If you're talking about death, you really have nothing much to learn from that, unless we drag in Olam Haba, which I don't plan to drag in, but in the discussion of Chasek Veskas he does, and his question on the Ravag is, Olam Haba could really be justification of Olam Hazeh, but he says, what about Kavet? After Kavet is nothing, assuming that Kavet means Nechvat Gamba, Kavet, Kavet, Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba. So the answer is that if it's really at the end, which he assumes means even after Olam Haba, and you're assuming it might be Olam Hazeh as well, then you have to say that's Tzedek. For that particular person, it's Tzedek. He has gotten his final judgment. But in the existence of the world, his death is not merely justified by what happens to him, but it's justified by what happens to others as well. In other words, looking at the pasuk, the Gemara that says Ki Tov Mavet, before Adam ate from God, from the Eitz Hadat, it says Vayar Elokim et kol asher asav v'hinei tov ma'od Ki Tov Mavet. That means the existence of death in the world is good for the world. Now, if you combine that with what the pasuk says explicitly, that death was decreed on Adam only because he ate of Eitz Hadat, it's a stira. Here it says, Tov Mo before Eitz Hadat, and this is only after Eitz Hadat. The answer is exactly the answer to your question. In other words, it's death is part of the world. But befoal, you also have to do something to deserve it individually. Death is good for everybody in the world. It's good for me that the fact that I'm going to die in the future is good for me. A simple pshat, not a complicated pshat. The pshat that's found in the guy in the bottom of the big Medrash Rabbah. Because I know I'm going to die in a year, therefore I bother doing positive things now. If I thought I'd live forever, so I have a different set of priorities, which involves mostly sleeping in the meantime and slowly, eventually, finishing the work that I have to do. But death introduces a certain amount of urgency to everyone's life. If it's a good thing. But nonetheless, when you die, it also has to be justified by sin. So it could be that the things work parallel. Again, you ask me, okay, I don't believe it. The tsunami, and in the 600,000 people killed in the tsunami, every one of them was a chote, and the people who came to save them, they were all the tzaddikim who were getting developed. I don't know. Yes! I mean, that's my assumption. That's the working assumption here. God has to take consideration this into consideration, and it's balanced out. The fact is that some people were saved, some people weren't saved. There's got to be a reason for that as well. It's a consideration of what can come of you. In the end, everybody's going to have to die. And if God thinks he can get something out of you, another few steps, so he'll give you a challenge. If you basically finished your course, not much more is going to come about. So he takes you to the next world where you presumably sit around and just get the reward punch for whatever you've developed now. The death doesn't bother me that much because I understand that death is part of the world. If you could find a case where nobody gets anything out of it, again, how much good and how much evil, we don't have the faintest idea how to balance. All I have to show to make this into a defense, a possible defense, is that some good comes out of evil. And that's all that I have to show. Now, what is the moral justification for God doing this amount of evil to this person, this amount of good for that person? That's his problem.
You said before, though, that you really can't necessarily claim that all 50,000 people that died, each one of them individually deserved death,
and
that
means
another answer?
Each one either deserved death, or I said I'd like to do another line out here, that not necessarily deserved death, I mean, they had deserved death, technically speaking, but who doesn't deserve death, technically speaking? If you sinned once, you deserve death. But also that it wasn't overweighed by God's hope of developing something out of them. So again, you can tell me, look, I know two people. This one did 70 years. This one died at the age of 19. You know, he told me at the age of 19, there was no place for him to go. You know, he wasn't the rush. He was a big tzaddik. I know tzaddikim who died at the age of 23. And there wasn't anything more for him to do. Of course, there was more for him to do. But there are other considerations. Whatever it is, it was justified. But in the big picture, how could it possibly be that unjustified evil exists? The answer is that all evil is justified, not by justice, but it's justified by what could come out of it. Among other things, sometimes nothing comes out of it because, again, you have free will. Something happened, and everybody failed the test. What can we do? It's a good thing that we live in a world which has tests.
Does that mean that people are punished not only on the basis of what's good for them, but they will occasionally be punished also on the basis of what happened?
But the word punish is an impossible word in that context. But yes, evil can take place to you because of the good which take place to other people. And that's okay. It's not okay in a specific case, but it's okay in a greater case because you will also gain from the evil that takes place to other people as well. In other words, there's a certain amount of poverty in the world. Everybody gains from the fact there's poverty in the world, including the poor people, not from their own poverty, but from, I don't know, from the next guy's poverty. So even an ani has to give tzedakah.
I once heard that Chazal said it was a good thing that the book of Refuah by Chizkiyahu was hidden, so that no one would start relying on it. But surely, if then God can always come up with new little things, A's or whatever, then surely it would have been a good thing. Why did they say it was a bad thing? Surely they should have given out to everyone, and then it would have been up to God to make new things.
The answer is the same thing. I don't know what the exact shot there was. The Sefer HaFuot presumably cured all. I assume that means it cured all illnesses. It was the secret. It wasn't a list of medicines.
Yeah.
It was a list of the spiritual basis for medicine. But Enoch and Ami, the question I asked before, and it's really true, if I had this book, would I have the chutzpah, the amazing achrayut, to burn it? Because what the Gemara says isn't that God took it out, but someone else took it out, right? Because God took it out. I find it hard to believe that I would do such a thing. You need a tremendous amount of responsibility to other people to make it worse for them in order to make it better for them. The Gemara says that's what they did. The Gemara is really giving an example of this theory, that too easy good which you don't have to work for, doesn't serve you. We've heard this theory endlessly in school and at home. Making it too easy for somebody does not necessarily help them. That's the theory that Gemara said there. The question that you're referring to was a question I raised before. Who has the guts? Who has the achrayut? Who has the mastery to make a decision to make something worse in order to make it better? Sometimes it's thrust upon you. If you're a teacher, that's what you have to do. If you're a parent, that's what you have to do. Maybe if you're a melech, that's what you have to do. Kings also make decisions like that. But it's a decision which involves being a tzemel king. Yeah?
So, we said that God made a system of moral development in which evil serves a role. But I never really addressed the question why God had to assign evil a role in the system.
Okay, exactly. Now, so the question I really want to talk about, which we'll talk about next week, is not the ethical question, but the logical question. The theory only works if two things are true logically, not true b'mikreh. Number one, the psychological principle, which I think we know is more or less true, that human personality develops by actions. But why is that true? Why didn't God make people simply that I choose to be good? I think it's obvious that it's true. It's a very important ethical consideration. We all know we like to be good. We shiva b'afim, we hear Musa. So therefore you go to the mirror and you say, be better. We all know that nothing happens. You can't simply make yourself better. The way you become better is by engaging in activities. That's true. But why is it true? Did God not have the ability to simply make us good without this roundabout method which involves injecting evil so we can overcome it? So you have to explain why it's logically true. Two is, why is God interested in soul building? Why didn't God make people perfect to begin with? If God is good, he should have made the world perfect. A perfect world has perfect people. Why did God make us imperfect beings and then say, now let's work for 70 to 120 years in hopefully making you better? The problem of evil, by saying that the evil is necessary to make worse people better, begs the question, why are there worse people to begin with? So that we're not going to talk about today because our time is up. We will talk about that. It's a crucial point to explain. Why is God interested in an imperfect world which in fits and starts and no sure method can become better, and only better through Yerida L'Tzarach Aliyah, from suffering in order to become better? What I want to leave you with, what did I want to leave you with? The point I want to leave you with now, before you get to that question, is there was something here, but you stole it, you knocked it out of my head. You did a great evil here. For good reason. To teach me to be more organized. Good in itself. Well, anyhow, there's an important point that I wanted to say here, and Chaval ad abdin velo mishtakim. You'll never get to hear it. Let's do some first. Don't tip my tongue. Oh well, we're finished.